you for pausing during your busy day to enjoy tea with Crystal, a glimpse inside a storyteller's mind. This podcast is brought to you by the Purple Prose Room and Harry Buns Productions, written, narrated, and produced by Crystal Brady Young, author of the book series Fate's Champions and Tea with Friends Cookbook. Copyright 2021. Hopefully, the label relationship novelist was explained to your satisfaction during the last podcast. It's all relative. In the event it wasn't, or this is your first time joining me for tea, basically it's just me stating my dislike of labels, or rather their overuse. If you're back for a third helping, bless you. Let's see if we can serve up another interesting topic to accompany our cuppa. Are trends really bad? Please pardon me while I rant a bit. We have a heavy dependence on trends. Whether they're bad or not is very much a matter of opinion, but sometimes there will be a tipping point when the market becomes oversaturated by a trend. What trends definitely prove is that human beings are herd animals, and we're probably more easily influenced than sheep. So just what is a trend anyway? The basic definition is a general direction in which something is developing or changing. They permeate nearly every segment of our lives, and identifying one before it takes off is the name of the money-making game. It's far better to be the originator of a trend, rather than jumping onto a fully loaded bandwagon. Recognizing the difference between trends and fads matters, too. Fads don't last very long and are the get-rich-quick schemes. Trends are supposed to be long-term, sustainable moneymakers. In other words, a sure thing. Both can be problematic for creatives. You might still learn something from a fad which contributes to your growth as an artist, but it's not as likely. Before perfecting something, you may abandon it for the next hot opportunity. Once a trend becomes entrenched in society, there is time to perfect your skills. However, you also run the risk of no longer challenging yourself to create a new trend. It not only comes down to the kind of artist you wish to be, but why you create in the first place. Are you simply trying to make a living doing something you enjoy, or do you want to leave a lasting impact upon society? These two goals aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but it's very rare to achieve both at the same time. Genre fiction is one example where tried and true tend to rule the day. And if we're being honest here, most trends are nothing more than variations of very old themes. Let's use billionaire romances as an example. Naughty rich boys as protagonists or villains are nothing new. Georgette Heyer's first novel, The Black Moth, was published in 1921. She followed it with 40 other romances, and deserves some of the credit for creating the still popular historical and Regency subgenres. Drawing room farces were one of her specialties. Georgette's very prolific contemporary, Barbara Cartland, preferred plucky, down-on-their-luck waifs who reformed rich rakes. The Harlequin imprint has been publishing contemporary romances, featuring uber-rich bad boys, for decades. Let's just say I read a lot of the aforementioned examples during my misspent youth. Adult me isn't a stranger to the occasional work of erotica, either. I didn't consider Fifty Shades of Grey particularly unique, other than the fact that the writing quality made it impossible for me to read it. Yes, I know I'm a minority. As both a reader and writer, I actually benefited from the days when the path to publication was more difficult. Anything which made it into print was required to meet at least minimum quality standards. Most of my favorite authors wrote genre fiction. They were not only talented storytellers, who possessed sophisticated senses of humor. They also exhibited a more than adequate grasp of good writing mechanics. Granted, all professional publishing houses employ a few editors, to keep a work on track and to do a bit of final polishing. But that's about it. Those of us who spent our formative years consuming nothing but professionally produced books developed high consumer standards. We're usually the first ones who will complain about a lack of professional editing for independently published books sold you know where. Arguing for the flip side, where is the joy in always producing something for the sole purpose of capitalizing on an established trend? Why bother making an attempt to tell a story unless you're investing something of yourself into the effort? For a rebel like me, this is the biggest appeal of independent publishing. There's very little in this life which beats the tingling feeling created by a sudden flash of inspiration, then acting upon it. That's when the real work begins. including pulling yourself through those days when you suffer from massive self-doubt. How does one conquer the status quo? First, you must accept that you might not even make a dent in it. Still, it helps to know and accept the truth about human history. The way early tribes initially survived still affects the storyteller, but just because it's a firmly entrenched attitude doesn't make it right. Working professional creatives, of all disciplines, have often had a difficult time reaping the financial rewards of their hard work and expertise. Ah, that poor starving artist locked away in a garret, working for bread crust, paint, and canvas. Why does this system still persist? It goes back to the dawn of time, when storytellers and cave illustrators, often the same person, provided their evolving skills for the benefit of their tribes. The entertainment and burgeoning knowledge they offered around the evening fire was considered community property. Now you know why most people fuss over the notion of paying for any work of art. What changed with the revolution into settled civilizations? Nothing really, as far as basic human nature is concerned. I'm reasonably certain our tendency to be voracious consumers was established pretty much from the beginning, along with the concept of leadership, also known as I'm special and you're not, usually by someone other than the resident storyteller. That started with tribal chiefs and eventually became known as the divine right of kings. Humanity's greatest con job ever. When one person declared their specialness entitled them to ownership of all the good stuff. Did the magical storytellers find themselves elevated with who's the man? It depends on the job description. Those who eventually became shamans and priests positioned themselves as indispensable to people of power. Those who became craftspeople were mere mortals like everyone else, only with a career and sometimes slightly better pay. Even though some created some of the most desirable objects we still long to possess. Only a few have obtained godlike immortality, though often not until after they died. And fast forward to present day. While more than a few royal families met their demises in the past 250 years, the divine right of kings concept never died with them. It's still very much embedded in our systems of government, including so-called democracies. The real power is held by those who control all the commodities. And trust me, they firmly believe it's their God-given right to keep them. In order to satisfy the masses' ever-growing desire for instant gratification and keep all that wealth in their pockets, they need to obtain some of those commodities quickly and cheaply. That includes the art which elevates our existence from mere survival to truly living. There's still a considerable amount of social cachet in being able to call oneself a creative or performer. Though unless they do it themselves, people seem to have the notion the act of creating is easy. Sadly, the belief that you should be able to achieve overnight success with a minimum amount of work or monetary investment is moving beyond trend and becoming a firmly entrenched belief. It's false gospel which does no one any favors. Don't even get me started on the increasing takeover of AI in all aspects of human endeavor. Sure, it can be bloody convenient, but at what cost in the long term? Constantly challenging ourselves to improve and grow will disappear without motivation. Expanding one's education or skill base used to allow an individual to seek better career opportunities. For the creative, it means having the ability to undertake all manner of interesting projects. I've mentioned watching Navalera on Netflix. Song Kang, who played Lee Chae-rock, took dance lessons for several months in preparation for the role, and I wouldn't be surprised if Park In-hwan, who played Mr. Sim, did as well. They did an excellent job, and it was a story to which I can relate. Not only because I'm a caregiver, but I returned to novel writing at the age of 50. For 20 years, I had no plans to resurrect my first book or do any other projects I'm working on at this time. Now, I'm writing books, recording audio, and completing other related productions. While I freely admit to consuming mass quantities of certain entertainment mediums, I've always been happiest when I'm creating something myself. I find it more personally satisfying to be a producer than a consumer. While it's had some good points, the publishing industry is just one example of the disservice corporations have done to all of us from the very beginning. From the get-go, they were founded on the premise it's perfectly acceptable to subjugate certain groups of people, in order to turn luxury items into cheap commodities for others with a bit of money in their pockets. That mentality still exists, but it's far more subversive these days, especially in first world nations, where people gradually acquired the notion achieving a goal is not supposed to be difficult. Alas, the internet hasn't created an equitable playing field. Oh, you want to be an independent creative, they whisper? Of course you do. Allow us to make it easy for you by providing all these free and cheap tools. In exchange, you'll provide lots of low-cost content to entertain the masses. Corporations simply created a new class of slaves, especially in the creative fields, who ultimately have little hope of being able to buy their own lunch with the work they create. It's still a version of same shit, different day, where they continue to insist we need a middleman and artists are paid less for their work. The lack of editorial supervision for authors is the only advantage offered by their so-called self-publishing platforms, because poor education no longer serves as a barrier. Unfortunately, our desire to find a bit of immortality makes us easy targets. Their conventional wisdom claims you have to give it away or price it low, in order to keep the fickle attention of fans and develop a following. If you can even find one amidst all the competition. And once you have one, how do you keep them without the financial motivation to improve your skill base? I guess it's not so difficult when your peers are also being dumbed down by the same education system. Paid labor has always been the largest expenditure of any industry. From the Industrial Revolution onward, the goal has always been the development of systems which eliminate it. This is for the sole purpose of paying more money to the people sitting at the top of the organization, and as wealthy investors. These days, even creative professions in all fields aren't safe from AI. No matter how we made our seemingly insignificant appearance in the vast universe, humanity's existence is still a miracle. Why are we so bound and determined to make ourselves obsolete? Here's the truth. The large majority of us have never been given a choice over the value the top 1% places on the rest of us. We only have value as long as they can make money from us. I can certainly understand the frustration and anger of professional artists, since I've experienced this attitude myself. As a graphic designer working in the business print industry, it was our job to make other businesses look like professionals. More than a few clients complained about the rates we needed to charge for our expertise and overhead. Heaven forbid if they had to pay even more for high-resolution licensed photography, the one service we didn't provide. Sure, I understand how budgets work. In my world, if you don't have enough money for something, you go without it. Or figure out how to do it yourself. Because clients hated to compromise, I was often forced to scour the internet for free usable images, something which not only ate up far more of my time than it should. I detested doing it for ethical, technical, and artistic reasons. Print production requires much higher image resolution than the internet, especially when a printing business regularly invests in the latest output equipment. Higher DPI does mean sharp, beautiful images, but it also makes low resolution increasingly obvious, especially for larger products like posters and banners. I never wanted my name associated with anything substandard, nor was I paid enough to be a miracle worker. Since I'm now in business for myself, I can understand wanting something for nothing in order to protect my bottom line. I can understand it, but I can't justify it, by using free or cheap artwork. I refuse to take advantage of other creatives who are trying to build their own careers, so I can develop a fan following with free and 99-cent books. That is one of the biggest reasons I do as much production work in-house as possible. Even more importantly, everything produced by Harry Buns Productions is exclusive because I don't sell it, except under my name on my website. Yes, I charge higher prices for my books, and my podcast episodes aren't free forever. It's a reflection of the time and money I have invested. Never mind all the obsessive editing I do on a novel before it's published. It takes me at least 2 weeks to formally typeset a book for print production. Trust me, you won't like my hourly rate for more than 20 years of experience. I haven't liked the trends I've seen from the consumer perspective either. What favors are authors really doing themselves by giving the ebook version of their work away, while they have a print version for sale? Traditional publishers don't do that, and neither should you. Due to a clutter aversion, I rarely buy print books any longer, unless it's something really special. You're missing a sale here by giving your ebooks away. Yes, print and audio are more expensive versions to produce, but that doesn't mean good quality ebook production is free. I have no excuse not to create products on par with traditional publishers, because I use the same industry standard applications for both print and digital books. It's not cheap. This is vanity publishing on a whole other level, and utilizing it on substandard stories isn't an option here. The old adage, you get what you pay for, still holds true. And very few new authors' books, free or low-priced, received a second chance from me. When I was still trying to read for pleasure, I spent a lot of time scrolling, in an effort to find something I liked. Remember, my time is valuable, and I'm not easy to impress. First impressions are still everything. If you manage to hook me with a compelling premise and decent writing, I'll take a chance and buy a copy. Books which fail to live up to their promise after that won't be read again, nor will I purchase anything else from the author. Sadly, I gave up a while ago on reading. Now I spend a lot of my free time watching streaming channels, mostly because I now invest a few hours a day creating my own stories. Both my eyes and mind need a break from the written word. Not to mention, all that obsessive editing makes it a knee-jerk reaction. No matter how good the writers and/or their editors are, I'm likely to find at least one pet peeve. Don't even get me started on those who completely forego outside editing or critiques because they believe it's not needed. Patrick lied to SpongeBob when he claimed it was safe inside his mind. Over the years, I've learned a few things about myself when choosing stories I find appealing. After being married since the late 1980s and raising two daughters, I had matured. When we're being nice, we call that a bit of water under the bridge. I'm not just referring to becoming a woman of a certain age. I found myself being put off by a steady stream of immature, selfish main characters, which is probably just a reflection of the author's ages. Then again, most of the conflicts between protagonists, especially in romances, have long been based on ridiculous misunderstandings, and all the other stuff guaranteed to kill a long-term relationship. Maybe it's past time the genre moved away from them as a means of building that relationship in the first place. I also don't like the trend of not disclosing word counts and metadata descriptions made available to consumers. That is the only information which provides the reader with a book's true length. Page count means nothing, especially with reflowable digital files. That will vary depending on screen size of the device displaying it. I am well aware certain subscription services pay compensation to authors based on number of pages read, which would seem to put books with a higher word count at an advantage. On my phone, which has one of the largest screens currently available, the reflowable versions of my books each have almost 600 pages. Because I'm a professional typesetter by trade, I'm well versed in all the little technicalities and nuances which affect final print production costs. The more paper you use per book, the higher the production costs. It also weighs more, increasing shipping costs, especially with hardbound covers. The number of pages in my print books is not an accurate indication of word count. Producing a longer book means keeping page count under control. I must use space wisely. More words per page is the name of the game, all while keeping a clean, easy-to-read appearance. Part of the reason I resorted to my own e-commerce bookstore was control over product quality and descriptions. I'm not lying about the 100,000-ish word count of my books, or the number of pages in the print versions. During the production phase, publishers have two choices. It's my suspicion that books have become increasingly short. I've read a few which turned out to be little more than light snacks, at least for me. I know full well how long it will take me to read something based on the word count. My professional background does provide one advantage when purchasing print. I can look at all the white space on a page and make an educated guess about a book's true length. Since that information is being withheld, I'm hesitant to buy anything digital because I might not be getting my money's worth. The smart reading consumer is not going to pay the same amount for a novella that they will for a full-length novel. Judging by submission guidelines I encountered recently, while pondering publication for my first book, there is not a significant word count gap between them anymore. I'm not particularly comfortable with audiobooks and podcasts either, though ignoring them as an income stream would be idiotic. I can definitely see the appeal for busy people with very little leisure time. Maybe it's because I have an overly suspicious mind, but I can't help wondering if their increasing popularity is being pushed by elitists. Why wouldn't they want to return the general population back to an uneducated state, where only a select few still get to read and write, and everyone else is told what to do? Reading is still the best way to embed information in the memory long term. Yet many people hate doing it even for leisure. Feels like work rather than pleasure, especially for those who struggle with the written word. Educated people are supposedly equipped to think for themselves, and they're far more difficult to control. That is a problem for the few people who own most of the world's wealth, especially when they are very outnumbered by the rest of us. It's been proven repeatedly, the moment we start taking something for granted, we lose it. I have mentioned storytelling's origins are oral, and it's still an art form. I'm making peace with myself by including it with the other creative endeavors I pursue. In other words, I'm expanding my repertoire, rather than replacing something. Not to mention, I've seen advice that those who write fiction in particular might want to consider hiring someone else for narration work. Excuse me? Telling me I can't do something is like waving a red flag in my face. Hello, storyteller here. Pardon me while I dust off my inner master thespian. 2020 proved to be a very disruptive year for a whole host of reasons, and so far, 2021 is only looking slightly better. This episode in history may seem like a first of its kind for many of us, especially younger people who have no living memories of true hardship. Like it or not, painful periods do provide useful lessons, starting with the fact human civilizations have always balanced on a knife's edge. It really doesn't take much to force a reset, and that includes our dependence on trends as a means of making decisions. Right now, the view in my crystal ball is rather murky. While we may finally be emerging on the other side of a difficult year, who knows what will ultimately appear out of the chaos it created? Nimble adaptability is easier to achieve by smaller organizations. Then there's a not-so-little issue that many people are benefiting from my hard work and financial investments well before I receive a dime. I tried wide-release distribution at the beginning. Making $2 from a $16 print book didn't make me very happy. Neither did I appreciate being paid for units sold, either in digital or print, 3 months after the fact by the distributor. Most people wouldn't work for an employer if they were treated like that. Yet they're willing to accept such idiotic terms in order to achieve a dream. Dreams are great as a starting place, but it takes guts and hard work to make them a sustainable reality. There are some days a purple prose room looks like a blessing, and others when it makes me feel like cursing. There is always a trade-off no matter what you do. The real question? What is the best decision for me? Yes, I'm responsible for everything on my website, but because it's paid hosting, I do get technical support when I need it. What do I get in exchange? I know my sales numbers in real time rather than receiving a report payment for my books every 3 months. And the sales funds are put directly into my bank account. I also know who buys them, instead of it being kept a deep dark secret by retailers. This is my opportunity to make friends with people who appreciate my hard work. And I'm working hard to earn their appreciation. Think about this for a moment. If we believe it's perfectly normal to purchase other arts and crafts directly from their creators, why can't we do the same from writers? None of the other businesses which have risen up around writers, in particular, would exist without you. Don't you think it's past time to shift the balance of power in your favor? Like it or not, the bridge of life only travels in one direction. Forward. Many of us experience a moment in our lives when we suffer significant damage and will never be the same person ever again. I thought it happened to our family when my husband became a disabled veteran at the age of 39. The episode took several years to resolve and definitely caused damage, including the financial kind. I was wrong. So very, very wrong. The worst I've now experienced so far, including trumping a pandemic, occurred in 2015. Shortly after we finally finished making repairs to our family's bridge, it was completely wiped off its foundation and swept away. You will have to pardon me for not disclosing all the details, My mom's death by suicide involved water. During the process of building a new personal bridge, I returned to novel writing as a means of therapy. Making the decision to be as independent as possible really wasn't that difficult. I'm no longer in the mood to compromise with industry standards when I create a story. While it has challenges, I already know what I'm capable of surviving. If my business endeavors as a storyteller fail, that's okay. It will never be the worst thing which has ever happened to me. Those who willingly dig deep to create something from their joys and sorrows should never be required to prove their worth. Remember J.R.R. Tolkien? He was a World War I veteran. Academics can argue all they like about whether Lord of the Rings is an allegory. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. The camaraderie and gut-wrenching losses detailed in those books came from his own personal experiences, period. Storytellers always write what they know, and what should they know better than themselves? When he wrote those books, there was no such thing as mental health for veterans with PTSD. Their fictional fantasy world provided a safe place where he could confront and conquer his nightmares. The end result was a timeless work of art with universal appeal. I used to only create happy things as a means of escaping my woes before my mom died. Pulling from my pain and writing stories with it is still one of the most difficult things I have ever done. If my stories gained any kind of depth, it is because I used them to reconnect with and repair the most damaged part of my own psyche. Because of that, I was able to rediscover joy. You might say my characters led the way when it comes to rising above adversity. Despite their positions in society and physical possessions, they place tremendous importance on personal relationships. I refuse to cheapen the experience by compromising to industry standards. It's not those standards, with their lists and awards, which truly give an artist's work lasting value. Instead, all that matters is the impression it leaves on the individual experiencing the work. It takes a soul to touch a soul. At this moment, it's difficult to say if I'm on the cusp of writing a very big trend. What I'm really offering is the modern equivalent of ancient storytelling. It was originally an intimate activity enjoyed by small family groups, who eventually morphed into communities. I will never know if I grow impatient and don't stay my course. Hoping to capitalize on or create a new trend wasn't the main reason for my return to writing in the first place. It's about rebuilding the woman who was devastated when her mother died, and hopefully showing others you can't truly conquer adversity by compromising or taking the easy path. Now, if that ever becomes a trend, it's one I'll promote wholeheartedly. You are listening to Season 1 of Tea with Crystal. This is Episode 3. Are Trends Bad? Narrated by Crystal Rady Young. Produced by Harry Buns Productions and presented by the Purple Prose Room. Copyright 2021.